Hey, good morning. First off, I wanted to, this is actually my first LISA conference, so it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks to the committee for inviting me to talk to you about this. You may have noticed in Andrew's, I'm a group leader for for the data systems group and at NERSC, and nowhere in that introduction did he say astrophysicist or cosmologist or rocket scientist. And so I just wanted to start off with a disclaimer that I'm none of those things, right? And so much about what I'm about to speak, I'm not an expert. So take everything with a grain of salt. That being said, I spoke to a cosmologist for a lot of this, and they said that cosmologists are often in error but rarely in doubt. So maybe it doesn't matter, right? Maybe it's all the same. So this is what I want to cover this morning. I'm going to first start off with the things I know the least about and move towards the things that I know at least a little bit more about. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the science of behind Planck, and then talk about the mission itself and some of the analysis pipeline that they do with the data. Then talk about NERSC, the center that I work at, and some of the other big data projects at NERSC, and then finish off with just sort of some general thoughts about working with big data and what some of the challenges are and what some of the future challenges are. So we'll start off with the science. And by the science here, I'm talking about the cosmic microwave background. That's what the Planck telescope is going to measure. So, you know, when you say start at the beginning for cosmology, that really means the beginning because you're talking about the Big Bang. The very, very beginning, right? So what is the cosmic microwave background? Some of you may be familiar with this, but just for those who aren't, essentially the cosmic microwave background is it's kind of the very first observable conditions that we can see from the Big Bang. It's essentially the first light that was able to actually kind of propagate. So about roughly 400,000 years after the Big Bang, finally things had expanded and cooled enough that you could start to get recombination of the hydrogen and electrons, and or the protons and electrons to form hydrogen, so the radiation could free string, right? Prior to that, there was basically no mean free path for the photons. So it's at that point that the CMB starts to propagate, and we're essentially observing when we have these telescopes. We're essentially observing that light that right before it scattered, you know, that last scattering after things had cooled enough. So the name CMB sort of comes from cosmic because it fills all of space, right? Microwave because it's now that's the range in the spectrum that it falls now. It's when it started off, the universe was much hotter and smaller and denser. And then as the universe has expanded, it's cooled down. So now it's in the microwave range. And then background, because it's essentially behind all the other things in the cosmos. So galaxies, stars, all of that sort of sit in some ways in the foreground of the CMB. They also create microwave radiation, but we're looking sort of behind those things. There's also things like dust and other things that can create microwave radiation. This is just another view, another sort of a graphic showing that, you know, there was radiation before, but finally things cooled, and then now you're basically letting that light propagate. So you're also seeing sort of back into the past as well, right? So why is the CMB interesting? One, I've already sort of alluded to, it tells us a lot about the Big Bang, right? Because it's this window into the past. But by looking at sort of some of the finer details of the CMB, we can infer a lot more about the universe. So we can understand the geometry and shape of the universe, its composition. Most of the universe is actually made up of dark matter and dark energy, and we can actually understand that because of the CMB. and also, you know, sort of some of the dynamics and the evolution, the history of the cosmos. It's also can be used as a window to look at high energy physics processes because, excuse me, in some ways the Big Bang was like the ultimate collider experiment, right? It created energies that we may never ever recreate on Earth. So there's another view of the Big Bang where they show where different accelerators, you know, high energy accelerators fall, you know, into the past, basically creating energies back in the past, but none of them have reached, you know, the energies that we can do with by looking at the cosmic microwave background. So we can also use it to understand fundamental forces. I'm just gonna keep track of time here. So the discovery of CMB is actually an interesting one. It was one of those sort of accidental, serendipitous type things. It was initially discovered by Penzias and Wilson back in 1965, and they weren't astrophysicists. They were sort of they were physicists working for Bell Labs trying to improve microwave antennas and transmitters. So one of the things they wanted to do is understand, get a very accurate measure of the types of backgrounds they'd observed. And what they noticed was is that there seemed to be this persistent background signal that they couldn't get rid of, and it seemed to be independent of, you know, the time of year, the time of day. And, you know, for a long time they thought maybe it was problems with the antenna. They thought it was, you know, pigeon droppings and stuff like that. And eventually they realized, no, it was real and it was coming from space itself. And this actually validated the Big Bang theory that was really an untested theory at that time. And that's actually led to them being awarded the Nobel Prize in 1978, the first Nobel Prize related to CMB. There's actually been one more. So those kind of discoveries are interesting. There have been, since then, there have been many other efforts to measure the CMB. I think once people realized there was what it could tell them about the universe, they wanted to measure it in more detail. So there have been a variety of ground-based experiments, balloon-based experiments. So a lot of times they'll launch these in balloons so they can try to get away from some of the terrestrial noise and get, get higher up into the atmosphere. They can get a better measurement. And then there's also been space-based measurements. The first was COBE, which is this image on the right, and WMAP was a more recent satellite launch. Planck, of course, is the most recent. So COBE actually led to the second Nobel Prize related to looking at CMB, and that was awarded to John Mather and George Smoot. Smoot is actually works at Berkeley Lab, so this is sort of a point of pride for the lab that I work at. And there they were looking at, so when Penzias and Wilson first looked at it and first observed it, it looked pretty isotropic, and it is really to a very fine level. You have to go down to like 10 to the minus 5 before you start seeing variations in the temperature across the sky. And so this was, COBE was really one of the first that allowed him to get to that kind of resolution. I'll let you guess which is the physicist and which is the king of Sweden. The more recent kind of development within cosmology is something kind of termed the concordance cosmology. It's also called the standard model of cosmology. And what's happened now is they've combined what we've learned from the cosmic microwave background along with something called the supernova. By observing supernova, we learn a different type of thing about the universe. So the supernova, which they do some of this work at NERSC and LBL as well. Here they're using a particular type of supernova called a type 1A. This is kind of interesting. It, it forms by sort of accreting matter, and then eventually it reaches a critical point and collapses, right? So that process is very well understood, and the type of radiation spectrum that it puts out and sort of its time profile is very predictable. And so they use it as a standard candle and look at the sky, look for supernova, and they can basically figure out what the redshifts are based on distance, right? So these become a good way to kind of understand the expansion of the universe and the dynamics of the universe. So by combining things like the supernova data with things like CMB, you get a much more complete picture, and it helps you kind of reinforce what you're learning from one or the other, kind of confirm it. So from the combination of these things, what we have learned to date are, is one, that the universe is essentially flat, and that means that you could have, there's certain assumptions about the universe. One is that, the main one is that it's isotropic, right? That it doesn't matter where you are, you're at, they're all basically the same. So there's only, when you constrain things that way, there's certain topologies that the universe can be in. So there's sort of this, these open models and closed models and flat models. Now a flat model essentially says that if you know a distance far away, you can measure the opening angle for it, and if it sort of fits our normal kind of trigonometry kind of relationships, then that's a flat model, that's a Euclidean space. But you can also have, if it was on a curved surface, then you would start to have like wider opening angles, right? So that's one of the things that we've determined from these types of experiments. The other one is that we know that we're in both an expanding universe and an accelerating universe. So, and the reason for the acceleration is interesting. People may have heard of dark energy. That's what is driving this acceleration, and it's essentially, you can think of it as sort of a negative pressure in the universe that's pushing it outward more. So that's sort of the state of things today, but there's still a lot that we, you know, find details about these that we don't understand, especially some of the details of dark energy and dark matter, and some of the details about the inflationary period, some of the earliest points of the Big Bang. And that's where Planck is supposed to help out, right? So now I wanted to look at the Planck mission. This is sort of its high-level goal, is to measure these fluctuations in the CMB accuracies that are set by fundamental limits. I don't really understand what that means, but it sounds impressive, doesn't it? So, further refine our understanding of sort of the early universe and its evolution and other details of the universe. So here's sort of the laundry list of objectives for the mission. Most of it centers around understanding things about the Big Bang, but there are other details of the universe, such as some of the structures we see, and even, you know, while you're mainly looking at the background, you can also look at the foreground too with this. So, you know, they can also look at properties of some of the galaxies as well. The satellite itself is it's a joint mission between the European Space Agency and NASA, and it was launched in this year. I'm going to talk a little bit more about where it's placed in orbit and some of the instruments on board. It's also going to create some of the biggest data sets for the CMB to date. So 10 to the 12 observations, this is all the time series data that will be taken from the satellite. And from those, you kind of drop down in, as you analyze the data, you build up maps, which are the sky pixels, and then you build up these power spectrum. So this is that's what those other components are there. But the key one really is the observations. The satellite is essentially a telescope, but it's for the microwave region, so you don't use sort of normal optics for it. It's got two sets of antenna array on it, a low frequency bank of instruments and a high frequency bank of instruments. And then in addition to the sort of focal plane components and the antenna, there's also the big portion at the bottom shielding and cryogenic cooling, because when you're trying to measure things at the levels that they want to do here, it's important that you get as much noise out of the system as possible. And so one of the things you have to do is cryogenically cool the detectors. And that's actually what limits the mission to 2 years. Earlier it talked about it being a 2-year mission. The primary reason is the cryogenic cooling. They've only got so much helium-3 that they can use to cool the detectors. That's primarily for the HFI, the low frequency could continue to run, but really the main heart of it is in the HFI. But you would never tell the LFI people that, because they're actually two different groups, and they're not competing against each other, but they both take pride in their parts, right? So this is just a close-up of the detector array, and I think, if I remember right, the part in the center is the HFI, and the larger horns on the outside are the LFI detector horns. And there are more horns than there are frequency spots, and that has to do with the other thing that it's doing is measuring not just the signal strength itself or the temperature itself, but also it's measuring the polarization too. So that accounts for some of the extra horns. Let's see. Oh, shoot. Trying to get this animation to run. There it goes. So the satellite was launched earlier this year on May 14th by the European Space Agency on this Ariane 5 here. And it was put in orbit around what's called the second Lagrangian point. There are certain stable points that you can put things in orbit relative to sort of the sun and the earth. The L2 is one of those. There's others that sit sort of in between the earth and the sun, and I think there's a third one that's maybe further out. But these are useful places to place objects, especially for observation. And for Planck, it's particularly critical because you need that it be on the outside of the earth, because you want to use that shielding to face the earth and the sun so you can block as much of the radiation from those sources. So the satellite's always positioned, with its rear facing the earth, and then as the earth orbits the sun, that's how it basically sweeps the sky. It's also rotating on an axis, but that only allows it to cover this kind of stripe, right? And then as it orbits the sun, then it picks up the rest of the sky. This is an animation just showing it sort of doing the map making process. And I think it's worthwhile to let it run just so you can sort of get a feel for what's going on. So like I said, it's spinning on this axis. I forget the exact period, but it's relatively slow. And then, so as it spins, it sort of sweeps out this part of the sky, and then it's slowly kind of processing the Earth orbiting the sun. And after 6 months, it will have done one survey. It will have, because it's spinning around, you pick up one half that way, and as it orbits the sun, then it sweeps it out. So at this point, it's about 3 months in to a survey, and then keeps coming around, and eventually at 6 months, it's done one full sweep. So here they've taken that, and now they're exploding it and flattening the image out. And then here you see what it looks like in sort of the visible spectrum range. And all this red area there, that's basically our Milky Way, right? And that would get, when you're looking at the cosmic microwave background, you would subtract that stuff out because you want to see what's behind it. And that's the reason why they need the multiple frequencies. There's sort of the CMB is black body radiation, so it has a very well understood kind of profile to its spectrum. And the foreground objects will have a different profile, so they can use that to filter these things out. You can also use it to filter out things like dust. This is just something that's kind of illustrate how the improvement that we're getting in these detectors and Planck relative to the previous two satellites. So, you know, here's COBE. This is the one that Smoot and Mather won the Nobel Prize for, from the data from that. And just look at the advancements in the resolution that we're getting in going to Planck. WMAP is still generating a ton of results, right? And so you can imagine what we can expect from Planck. And this is just another way to kind of look at that. This is the power spectrum. I'll talk a little bit more detail about this, but this is how the scientists tend to look at the data because they can use this to map back to kind of certain processes. And so WMAP, the best experiment to date, you see the error bars, especially as you go out here into sort of higher L values. And you see one that Planck extends a lot further out, and just the resolution on it is incredible. So now I wanted to explain a little bit about how these power spectra are created. I'll admit I don't completely understand it, but I'll do my best. So first I wanted to talk a little bit, though, about how the data gets to NERSC and NERSC's role in this project. All right, so the data is beamed down from Planck to various ground stations. One of the main ones is in Australia, but it's run by the European Space Agency. And they also beam, occasionally will beam back stuff to the satellite to retask it with things, for example. After a little bit of analysis, the data is split off, and the low-frequency data goes to one center, and the other one goes, the high-frequency goes to another. It's Paris and Trieste. I forget which is which. I think the LFI goes to the Italians, and the French are handling the HFI. They do some basic kind of cleanup. They'll filter out some of the noisier things that they know is kind of junk data, and then it's sent to various places, one of which is IPAC, which is Infrared Processing and Analysis Center, I think is what it stands for, but it's run by JPL and NASA, and they also archive the data there as well. All right, so these are kind of formal parts of the Planck data pipeline, right? So I want to distinguish that NERSC is not technically a formal part of it, but we're doing a lot of the analysis because we have computational resources that the other places don't have. So we get a copy of the data, both sets, the LFI and HFI. When I originally pitched the talk, I was thinking that I would talk a lot about how this data's moved around, but I guess that wasn't, after talking with the scientists, they're like, that's pretty straightforward. So instead, I'm going to talk a little bit more about how that data is analyzed. So what you start off with is essentially a time series kind of measurements like this. So, you know, samples over time and sort of their strength, their signal strength for these different frequencies. And from that, they build up these maps. Now, this is a simulated map because, you know, you'll notice there's no Milky Way or anything like that. So this is a simulation, but this is sort of representative of what they would want to get from Planck. And there's a couple of things that they have to do in going from here. One is the time order data. These detectors have a response and sort of relaxation time. So if they hit a hot spot, they'll heat up, and you have to sort of account for that as it moves. It'll start to cool back down. But you need to correct for that in the map-making process. And then there are other kind of noise-related pieces that they'll filter out, and that's the primary thing they're trying to do is get rid of the noise and try to build up an accurate representation of the signal. So the methods that they use today are kind of iterative in nature. They start off by, this is my understanding, they start off by sort of putting in some values for it and then iterate it over time based on the samples to get to sort of a Gaussian best fit. After they've made the maps, they will then build up these power spectra. And here, you know, mathematically, it's just a sort of a expansion in spherical harmonics. But a way to sort of think of it is, as you go up in these L values, you're sort of looking at the feature sizes at a tighter and tighter level, and how much of the signal you see sort of fall in at that feature size, right? So if I remember right, there's my pointer. You know, somewhere around here is roughly like a degree in space. So that corresponds to sort of these features that you see around here that are pretty prevalent. But this shape that you see to it right here with all these little bumps, those correspond to what's called baryon acoustic waves, and it's kind of the dynamics that the universe was going through right before it, you know, went through that critical point, right? And so you get these kind of oscillations building up, and they have certain features, and by looking at the exact placement of these peaks and their relative height, you can really start to understand what the you know, how much dark energy, how much baryon matter there was, things like that. So this is where these little details right here is where they really learned the most about the early universe. The other lines you see here are for the different polarization modes that they're also measuring with the detector. So this is, I'm going to go through this in detail because I don't understand most of it, but this is kind of how they're doing the analysis. And like I said before, they're doing this sort of Gaussian best fit with the map making. And then the other thing that's interesting is they've had to really change their methods and how they do this, because they wanted to, computationally things are getting harder, so they need to scale up to larger systems. And so they've had to change away from sort of exact methods to more iterative methods that, like the ones I was talking about. So you see some of these scaling orders down here and why they've had to change it. It's actually explained in a little more detail, but one thing I will say is one of the key things is figuring out how big these error bars should be. And the way they do that is they kind of move forward through the process like I described and generate this power spectra with no error bars. And then they sort of generate, they work backwards. They sort of generate maps that correspond to that spectrum, but with these, they get the noise from the time order data, and then they start building up a bunch of maps that sort of meet those statistics, right? And then they make another power spectrum, but it'll be slightly different because of the noise characteristics, right? So they do that enough times to figure out basically how big their error bars should be for the power spectrum. And that's a critical piece of the analysis process. This is just showing kind of gives you an idea of how things have grown over time. So COBE back in 89 was roughly a billion time samples. Boomerang, which was one of these, the balloon-based ones, took about the same amount of data. This was the one that really fed into the concordance model that I was talking about. And then you just see how things are progressing. And what you see is, you know, things won't stop with Planck. We'll have other experiments further out that will generate even larger amounts of data. So CMB folks are looking out in the future and figuring out how in the heck are they going to deal with these problems as well. Let's see if there was anything else to say there. And this is just an explanation of how the analysis methods have kind of evolved over time. The boomerang data, which is the B98 here, and maybe the B2K, these were some of the first experiments, cosmic microwave background experiments, that used supercomputers for analysis. So this really set a trend within the field, because prior to that, I think they were basically done on kind of desktop scales. And, you know, they started off with these kind of exact methods where they would build up these huge correlation matrices. But over time, they've had to move. When you have things scaling to the third, you're kind of screwed, right? You can't do that for too long. So as they've scaled up, they've moved towards these kind of iterative methods, both in the map making and the power spectra. So then you get to things that are sort of analog N based on the number of time samples, though not the number of pixels. So this is mainly just to illustrate sort of that evolution in the code, but and also just to see the platforms that are running on and sort of the scale that they're running on. So there, you started off in 2000 running on a Cray 2-3, a very large SP system that NERSC used to have that ran on those, and now they're running at pretty large scales on our Cray system. I think I've covered most of this, so I won't spend much time. But there is one thing here, which is it was in these most recent things, especially when they were doing some of the simulations for Planck, not analyzing the actual data, but trying to simulate what they would expect from the satellite, that they really started to run into some pretty serious I/O problems. And so a lot of that was just because they were using fairly straightforward methods for doing their I/O. We've seen a lot of codes where the I/O sort of lags the rest of the simulation and algorithmic techniques that are used. So what they've moved towards is a lot more, they're trying to reduce the amount of I/O they can do as much as possible, and they're doing things more in situ if whenever they can. And that's sort of one of the tricks to doing large data is don't do I/O if you can possibly avoid it. I'll talk about that more. Okay, so now I wanted to maybe get a little closer to things that probably are of interest to you guys and talk about NERSC, which is the center that I work at. And I've already talked a little bit about the role that we play with in Planck. So NERSC is the flagship computing center for the Department of Energy's Office of Science. At a high level, DOE is broken into different offices, some of which do, say, classified weapons work. That's not us. There's another one that does. It's Office of Science that really does a broad range of scientific research. And the Office of Science is further split into these different program offices, one of which is called OSCAR. That's the one that funds most of the computing research as well as some of the facilities. And it's operated at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, NERSC is, but it's focused on delivering sort of production, high-performance computing. So I'll talk about a little bit about the user base. History-wise, it's actually been around for a long time, since 1974. It started off at Lawrence Livermore, something like the Controlled Thermonuclear Research Center or something like that. That's a catchy name that you want to have around these days, right? So eventually they renamed it to NERSC, and the exact meaning of the acronym has changed over time. But in 1996, it moved to Berkeley Lab, and primarily because it was focused on doing, non-classified open science, and being at Livermore was kind of impeding that. So they recompeted and it moved to Berkeley Lab, which is doesn't have any classified work. And it's our flagship center. I'll talk a little bit about what, there's other facilities that DOE operates, and I'll sort of distinguish those from NERSC. We have a large population. This is one of the things that distinguishes us. 3,000 users, hundreds of projects, right? And lots of different codes that we have to deal with. These are the different program offices. I've got another slide on the next one that breaks it out by sort of scientific areas that's a little easier to understand. The main point here is that it's not just one office or one program office that we support. We support all of them. So that is a challenge. We focus on sort of providing high-end computing resources, high-end storage resources, both in disk and in archival storage. And then we also have a high connectivity to the ES network, the Department of Energy's high-speed network. It says soon to be 100 gig. Currently today, we have multiple 10 gig links into the center. And we allocate our resources both on time on the systems as well as storage in the archival storage system. This is the slide I was talking about. So here now we're looking at more by disciplines that we support. And the main takeaway here is just one, there's lots of different groups that are running on the center, on the systems. And the other one is that it changes, the mixture changes a lot over time, right? So we can't just say build a system that's made to support climate and be done with it. We really have to procure systems that are going to satisfy a large group of different types of algorithms and codes. So, and that's reflected in the procurement processes we use. So we have a sort of a benchmark that we do that's based on applications, and we select representative codes when we procure the systems. So some of you may have heard of some of the other DOE facilities from the Office of Science. There's these leadership facilities at Oak Ridge and Argonne. The difference between NERSC and those is these are really focused on supporting a small number of projects that are expected to use a large fraction of the system. They're expected to scale up to a large fraction of the system. And the award process is sort of, they put in proposals and they're reviewed they're reviewed by the centers themselves. NERSC is sort of, that we give time out to the various sort of sub-offices, and they know what research is going on, and they know who they've funded to do research, so they can award time to those projects that they know need it. So this gives the offices a little more control over the process, and hopefully that leads to more science coming out of it. We also don't have quite the same kind of expectations on scaling. We still are expected to have users run at large scale, but we're not measured on it the way the leadership facilities are. System-wise, we try to have two large systems on the floor at any given point in time. That hasn't quite been true recently, but we're working our way back to that. Today, the sort of flagship system is this Cray XT4 called Franklin. We name our systems after scientists. So these are almost 10,000 nodes on the Cray. On the XT4 systems, a single socket sort of corresponds to a node. So these are quad core nodes, and this gives almost 40,000 cores on the whole system. And it's connected with a proprietary C-Star interconnect that Cray provides. That's their main value add in these types of systems. We have 2 gigabytes of memory per core, or 8 gigabytes of memory per node. And then there's different ways we can look at it. We tend to prefer this sustained system performance metric, which is 26 teraflops. This is sort of what we'd expect real codes to get. But if you look at it based on a peak value, it's roughly 355 teraflops peak. I think when it debuted after our quad core upgrade, it was somewhere in the number 5 on the top 500 list. And like everything, we've floating down now, or sort of sliding down the scale. We're actually in the process of rolling out a new system, which is going to come in phases. It's also going to be Cray-based. We did another procurement, and Cray won out on that. This was just recently announced. This system's going to be called Hopper, and the first phase of it's going to be a Cray XT5, a fairly small system, and then later this next year, we'll be taking delivery of the second phase that'll be based on the next generation of the Cray roadmap, and it'll have their next generation interconnect in it as well. I don't have it up here, but sort of storage-wise, we have roughly about 400 terabytes of storage, 450 terabytes of storage on this system with, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 gigabytes per second of bandwidth. On the Hopper system, it'll have over, I think it's almost 2 petabytes of storage, and it'll have around 70 gigabytes per second of I/O bandwidth. And these are critical for supporting the applications that run on those. We have other smaller systems. We've got some IBM cluster, as well as an pretty aging Linux Networks cluster that's a sort of single core Opteron, single data rate IB. But both of those are due to be phased out later this year, but it may get delayed a little bit so that we can bring in a new Nehalem-based quad data rate IB cluster that's going to replace both of those. That was just recently awarded, and we're hoping to take delivery of that cluster in the coming months. We also have a sort of throughput-oriented kind of serial batch processing cluster called PDSF that primarily supports high energy and nuclear physics. And that actually has a different model. These are all allocated. Like I said earlier, PDSF is sort of this buy-in model where the projects can buy systems, we'll run them for them, and then we give them a fair share of that resource. So it's kind of a different way to provide cycles. We also have the data-related pieces. NGF is the file system that my group runs. That's my primary baby here. And we have 400 terabytes, a little over 400 terabytes in it today, with 5.5 gigabytes of bandwidth. Should be more than that, but that's sort of where we are today. It's GPFS-based. Parallel file systems are very important in these systems. And in addition to that, we run a very large archival storage system. This 60 petabyte capacity is kind of a made-up number because it represents putting every tape slot with the highest capacity cartridge you could get, which you would never actually do. But as far as where we are today, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of over 7 petabytes stored in it. And then we also have a pretty old Altec system that eventually we hope to replace too. I just wanted to at least talk a little bit about, since the focus here is on data, to talk about NGF, the global file system. So as I said, it's GPFS based. The reason we started running this about 3 or 4 years ago, and the reason was scientists were telling us that it was kind of burdensome for them to have to move data between systems, and they wanted something where they could put it in one central spot and see it, but still get it high performance, right? So this was our answer to that. This is sort of how it looks today, from a topology standpoint. This is NGF itself sort of in this upper corner, but we have a large SAN that connects to connects into the various systems. And how we support the different systems kind of depends on many of them. What we've moved towards is this, what we call private NSD model. So you have dedicated servers that sit directly on the high-speed interconnect of that system. So for example, on BASI, which is an IBM system, it sits on the Federation interconnect. And on these other systems, it sits on the InfiniBand interconnect. So that way you can really leverage the bandwidth of the interconnect. And sometimes you can also leverage things like the RDMA capabilities of the network. On Franklin, we have to take a slightly different approach. Because there are so many nodes on the system, we wouldn't really want to run native clients out there. It's also a really stripped down, kind of lightweight OS. And so we could probably run the clients, the GPFS clients, out on the compute nodes, but it would be a bad idea. So the way we tackled that is Cray has a product called DBS that essentially takes the I/O from the compute nodes and ships it over to a set of servers that run the native client, right? So the GPFS client runs here, and then the compute nodes ship all their I/O here where it's sort of performed, and the results are shipped back if it needs to. So this kind of I/O forwarding capability is also used in systems like the BlueJean architecture as well. This is a good way to kind of scale up file systems in my view. And also it allows you to support file systems that you may not otherwise be able to support on the compute nodes. So that was sort of a quick overview of some of the systems at NERSC. Doing okay on time. Now I want to talk about some of the other big data projects at NERSC in addition to Planck. So one of the things that we've kind of observed is a lot of these science programs are really able to generate data at ever-growing rates. It's almost outpacing their abilities to store and analyze and archive the data. It's certainly challenging us. And a lot of this growth is being driven by the same things that drive the growth in the computer systems. Is you've got CCDs or other kind of solid-state components, and they're leveraging Moore's Law too, so that allows them to create growing amounts of data. So we see that both in things like telescopes, but we also see it in things like sequencing apparatus and bioinformatics. And many of these data sets are growing exponentially. So petabyte data sets are right on the cusp. We've already starting to see some of these appear. So in climate, for the next set of IPCC runs, these are the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. These are the large runs that are done to sort of understand climate change. Those are expected to generate tens of petabytes of data. And in genomics, JGI, the Joint Genome Institute, is one particular institute we work with. They're talking about having, you know, half a petabyte this year and doubling after that. Particle physics has always had a reputation for generating huge amounts of data. So once the LHC comes back online, they're talking about generating, you know, staggering amounts. This gets shipped throughout the world as well. And likewise in astrophysics, both in CMB, but even more so in some of the telescope data, these are growing pretty rapidly. So this growth is also sort of redefining the way people do science. What you see is you have these huge data sets and you build up big communities. And so it used to be that sort of a closed group of people would create the data and analyze the data. Now you're seeing really that go to a much broader community. Climate, we've seen that in a lot of cases where you may have people that aren't really interested in the simulation side of it, but trying to look at the impact side, for example. For NERSC, a turning point was in 2003 when we saw that we sort of shifted from before we were running simulations and pushing the results out, and in 2003 it sort of shifted to we were more of a data sink, especially from a lot of these observational and experimental projects. This is just a list of some of the different projects at NERSC. This is a very small list. These are just the ones that do a lot of data intensive work. And I'm not going to try to explain everything, but I think some of the interesting things here is, you know, we're starting to see projects that computationally they may not be requesting a lot, but they're requesting a lot of storage allocation. So this SRU is a kind of an in-house unit that it has a component both for how we store, how much data is stored over time, as well as how much data is pushed in and out and the number of files. So it's a combo unit, but roughly it corresponds to 1 million of these is roughly about 100 terabytes. So that gives you an approximate scale. But if they did a lot of data movement, then they would store less. It's almost like Amazon's S3 model. You know, it has charges both for data in and out and as well as how much you store. You know, and so astrophysics, we've seen a growth in there. Nuclear physics has always had a reputation for this. In a lot of these nuclear physics experiments, the reason they're not requesting any computational time is not because they don't do any computation, but they do it on that PDSF cluster, so we don't have to allocate that. That's why they have zero amounts in there. And then in climate, like I said, is another one. These down here are more of our sort of traditional kind of models where people are running simulations and they want to archive the checkpoint files or maybe some of the outputs from the simulation. So these, you know, you see large amounts of computation and storage. So this is what we're kind of accustomed to. But some of these others that are more driven by experiments, you really see this in heavy imbalance. So I've already talked about this in detail. I wanted to go through just a few of these and kind of highlight them. So CAMLAN's a neutrino experiment. So this is from the nuclear physics kind of side of things. NERSC has actually supported neutrino physics for quite a while now, and including some of the results that came out roughly, not quite a decade ago, but first realized that the neutrino wasn't quite massless, and you could see these oscillations between different neutrino states. So some of that, a lot of that analysis was done at NERSC. This is CAMLAN, is one particular neutrino detector in Kamiokande, Japan, and the interesting things here are just to look at the amounts of data that they've taken over this six-year period and sort of the kind of data rates that they're generating, you know, in a steady state. So I think all of these, they actually shipped the tapes to us. They tried moving it over the network, and it just wasn't efficient enough. So you stick it on an airplane and fly it over. ELISE is an up-and-coming collider-based experiment. It's going to be at the LHC. They're just in the process of kind of getting things ramped up on that. But here they're looking at sort of QCD, quantum chromodynamics kind of processes. And specifically, I think they're looking for something called the quark gluon plasma. At least this is sort of an extension of sort of an evolution of some work that was done at RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider at Brookhaven, which PDSF and NERSC supported a lot of that work. So, you know, here they're talking about we're in the process of trying to stand up facilities at NERSC and at Livermore to support this project, and they're talking about pretty large amounts of data, so 600 terabytes sort of in the first year is what they're asking for, and eventually, you know, they're talking about over its lifetime to generate many, many petabytes of data. Another area that we see a lot of large amounts of data is from the climate side, both in the IPCC runs, but also this is an interesting one here. They wanted to go through and reanalyze data from the 20th century. And this is challenging because you don't have satellite data and you don't have balloon data for most of this. So they have to take what they can get, which is mainly a lot of observational data, you know, from surface temperatures and pressure and stuff like that. So they have, what they've been doing is taking that data and then building up a more complete sort of representation of the weather from those periods. So it's really meant to try to bridge, the goal here is to try to bridge climate and weather. I was just reading a quote sort of that climate is what you expect and weather is what you get, right? So that's the, people confuse the things a lot and say, wow, it's getting hot, so they're wrong, or, you know, they're right. It's, you really have to step back. Climate's about the big picture and the sort of large trends. But at the same time, what we want to do with climate models is really go from understanding these large trends and trying to understand impacts and understand what's the impact on local weather. So this is one step in trying to do that is to take past events and then use those as validations for these models. One of the things here is to look for some of these extreme kind of weather patterns. And one example is the this Knickerbocker storm, which was a kind of infamous storm from 1922, because, and it's named that because it led to the collapse of the Knickerbocker Theater in Washington, D.C., and it wound up killing like 100 people. So trying to take these models and recreate those kind of events or explain those kind of events is one of the goals here. Another thing from the climate side is looking at cloud resolving models. Most of clouds right now in current climate or previous climate models and even current ones, I think, are really dealt in a parameterized fashion because it's just computationally too difficult, right? So they're trying to do the first steps in simulating clouds. This is really is in one of these kind of exascale problems. So this is something that would really drive future systems. But one step in that is they have to come up with a new way of kind of representing the data. Most of the climate data to date has used kind of standard polar coordinates, but those don't work well when you're trying to go to these really, really fine mesh sizes because you get these odd things at the poles, you get singularities, and you get strange shapes, right? So they're going to these sort of isohedral type grids, and so there's a lot of development just algorithmically to deal with that. And it generates large amounts of I/O, so there's been challenges in working around that. So that's the I/O kind of critical part of it. And then the last one I've got is JGI, the Joint Genome Institute. JGI does, they don't do human genome type stuff, they do microbial genomics. And when I first heard about this, I'm like, why do we hear about this? And, you know, I've actually been helping these guys out recently, and you look at some of the things they've sequenced, and it's like cow gut, right? And you're like, why do they care about things in cow gut? Well, the reason is because one of the things that they're trying to look at is biofuels. And a big component of biofuels is looking at trying to do these kind of enzymatic reactions so you can break down things like switchgrass, right? So here they're taking, that's why they're sampling things from like cow gut, because they have, you know, they have microbes in there that are breaking down these grasses, and so we're looking to see if there's ways we could leverage that. But the interesting thing here from a computational standpoint is they're moving from these old sequencing lines like that were called Sanger to newer ones like the 454s and Illumina. These are new next generation sequencing machines, and these things are both much, much faster and much, much cheaper to operate. So I've seen the sequencing lines at JGI, and they're, you know, rooms full of these things and a bunch of people running them too. And then you go to the Illuminas and it's like in one room and there's three people running this thing. So this was what was used to do the Human Genome Project, and now they're going to this. So you can imagine the kind of explosion in data. The challenge is one, dealing with that data, and the other one is computationally they haven't really figured out how to handle this stuff either because they have different characteristics for these sequencers. So a lot of interesting challenges in that area. One of the other things that we've recognized at NERSC recently is that you need ways to effectively share this, the data that you're archiving, simulating, storing, et cetera. And so we've been looking at how we can stand up science gateways to support some of these projects. And I have one example, Deep Sky, that I'll look at specifically. But there's some others that we've tried this out on. I think this is something that the NSF community has done for a while, and I think it shows a lot of promise. This is where you really build up communities around data, which is empowering. So one that was sort of a pilot project for us on this is called Deep Sky. And here we're taking data from different observatories and trying to build up deep images of space, meaning being able to go very far, you know, out in distance. This this grid over here, this image is sort of, it's the sky, and the red areas are where we have, I think it's like hundreds of images, and as you go towards white, you have a handful of images that cover that patch of the sky. The reason you, this data comes primarily from things looking for, asteroids and stuff like that. So they avoid this area right here because that's the Milky Way and it's too intense to really see anything. So that's the reason there's these black patches where there's no data. It's not because it's not interesting from a astrophysics standpoint, but it is for what these observatories are looking for. So anyway, the interesting thing here is they have 90 terabytes of data sitting on the global file system, and that's directly accessible through this web interface sitting on one of these science gateways. So a lot of the work that we did was both in supporting it from a resource standpoint, but also helping them to build up a web interface to be able to go and search this data. Really, the goal here is to be sort of like a Google Earth for astronomers. Right? There are other examples of projects that have done similar things, but here we want to do with higher quality images, deeper images as well. And just a brief slide on some of the test beds that we're running. You know, GPUs is a rapidly kind of emerging technology, especially within the HPC space. So we do have some test beds around those. And then we just recently announced, it was announced that DOE made funding research around clouds. Both us, NERSC and Argonne, will be standing up systems to do this research. And so here what we're looking at is trying to figure out, you know, how is this applicable for scientific computing? Is it applicable? What are the right ways to do this? And then also look at how it is from a cost effectiveness standpoint. We also have some evaluation on solid state storage. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And a limited amount of, also some stuff around FPGAs. So finally, I wanted to look at, I think I'm doing okay on time, is some of the challenges and general sort of thoughts on working with big data. So over the past few months, I've been sort of thinking on, okay, well, what are some of the keys to success? Since I knew I had to give this talk, trying to think about what are some of the kind of common things that successful projects do. And this was the list I came up with. It's not to say it's complete, but at least it's some of my thoughts on it. One is where you see, as I've said this a few times, is the most successful ones really build up a community around the data. And in order to do that effectively, that means everybody has to sort of agree on a common data model. And so this is tough because it's as much a social experiment as it is a technical challenge, right? So, but addressing this early on is really what leads to a lot of these successes. So, In climate, you have lots of examples of that. There are for things like the Earth Observation Systems, I think is what it's called. NASA sort of said, this is our model. This is what everybody's going to sort of conform to. In biology, you have things like the FASTA format that's pretty much universal. Everybody can sort of deal with it. Another one, this is more from a technical level. You really need parallelism at all levels, right? I mean, if you're going to look at terabytes or petabytes of data, you can't be doing it from a single node. You've got to have large parallel file systems. That means both in the storage behind it and the file systems clients and then the application too, right? So That's key. Now, in the HPC community, we've been doing this for decades now, right? So it's pretty natural there, but in some other spaces, they're just now kind of recognizing this and starting to make the changes in their algorithms to deal with it. You have to design for failures, and you have to think about data integrity. I'll talk a little bit more about how this is such a challenge, but you know, from a failure standpoint, you need to make sure there's redundancy. And this goes beyond just doing simple RAID 5 or something like that. You really have to go deeper than that. If you want to do high bandwidth, then you can't do it, you know, in 4 kilobyte chunks. You just won't get there. So you need to do big IOs as much as possible. You know, random seeks on a hard drive are the most expensive thing you can do. And better yet, if you can avoid it, just don't do IO, right? So this is just a rough kind of approximation, but you know, a byte per second of disk bandwidth is roughly about 1,000 times the cost of a flop, right? So, and that doesn't even count the network to move the data around, right? So if you can calculate it, you might be better off, or if you can store it and keep it in memory, then you might be better off. And then finally, you know, think about, especially for some of these observational things, you really have to think about the full life cycle of the data, and you need to think about what other information do you want to take along with the data, such as where did it come from, how is it generated, you know, other critical metadata. One of the things that we've kind of observed is that data from observation experiment actually grow in value over time, right? You can't go back and remeasure the weather from, you know, the early 20th century, right? So that stuff gains value over time. Simulation gets cheaper over time. You can always, if you know the codes and stuff, you can always rerun those, right? So in these fields, data is really the most important thing. Okay. So what are some of the enabling technologies, at least from NERSC standpoint? One is scalable archive systems. We at NERSC, they use HPSS, which is a collaborative development effort between IBM and several of the national labs. IBM actually productizes it and sells it, so it is a product that you can buy from IBM. But it's mainly designed to scale from a, you know, data in and out standpoint. And you know, in the archive space, in some ways you say, oh, it's a decade old. That doesn't sound very modern. But it's not like it's set still. It's evolved over that time. And from an archive standpoint, you want to be able to put it in there and know you can get it out later, right? This is the lifetime of a lot of this data, so it has to be able to live on that kind of time scale. And it also scales both in bandwidth and capacity. Parallel file systems are certainly key. And there's many examples, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses. We use both GPFS and Lustre at NERSC. GPFS on our center-wide file system, and Lustre on the Cray's. These are POSIX compliant, you know, file systems that are highly scalable both in capacity and bandwidth. So that's important. The other thing about these types of parallel file systems is they're designed for, you know, many clients to write to the same file concurrently. So that's something you usually can't do in NFS. The semantics just aren't there. Now, parallel NFS is supposed to address that, but you know, that's certainly a limitation. Now, there are non-POSIX compliant file systems. There are file systems that are designed to work with, example, MPIO, or there's things like HDFS. But sometimes you know, that might require significant retooling in the application, so it just depends. Another one is data management middleware kind of pieces. So HDF5 and NetCDF are popular kind of tools for both give you ways to do the IO effectively, but also they give you a way to do, really, to create data models, right? Especially HDF5 is specifically really about creating data models. So these help you organize your data, and then they also have libraries that help you kind of scale it up. Now, there's been some weaknesses there that people are working through, but it's probably easier to do that than to have every user trying to become an expert on IO. And then finally, there's data analysis and visualization tools. So things like Visit, Root, horrible name, but it's a package that high energy physicists use for analysis. So popular in that arena, and things like the visualization toolkit. There's others, but these are just some of the examples we thought of. I wanted to say a few words about MapReduce just because it's getting a lot of attention. Now, this has not really entered the scientific space full force yet. I think the jury's kind of still out on it. But certainly in the enterprise space and in the Web 2.0 space, it's huge. Right? And so because of that, it's getting a lot of investment, and I think that's one thing that makes it interesting. MapReduce was sort of this model that was heavily championed by Google. They gave a presentation, I think, in like 2005, saying, hey, this is how we're doing everything on the back end side, and we're using this kind of MapReduce framework and coupling it with our Google file system. And so I forget the fellow's name, but someone that worked with the Apache project, you know, looked at that and said, wow, that's really wild. Maybe I could do that. So he started writing something that basically led to Hadoop, an open source implementation of this. So here, the key things about these MapReduce and Hadoop and GFS are, first of all, they're designed from the beginning to scale, and they really build fault tolerance and fault resistance into the whole framework, right? So they have lots of data redundancy, they store multiple copies, and they have checksumming to make sure the data is still correct. And then the other thing that's interesting about it is they kind of couple the workload manager with the file system, so they, rather than moving the data around a lot, they'll move the map task to the data, right? So this allows them to run on very inexpensive commodity Ethernet networks, right? Which is why they were doing this. So this is certainly a very different kind of approach to things versus the sort of centralized file systems that we're doing. They're very well suited to unstructured data, which is what they're primarily used for in the Web 2.0 space. They're doing log analysis, clickstream analysis, and then using this to build up. You name it. It's amazing how much stuff is powered by this. I went to a conference, the Hadoop Summit, a couple of months ago, and I was just staggered by the amount of people there and all the different communities there. Scientifically, I think we're still trying to figure out how we can leverage it. So there are some places where it's easy to apply it, like some of the high energy physics analysis or bioinformatics. So those are sort of the first places we're looking at it. But then for structured data, like grids and meshes, stuff like that, it's a little bit trickier as to how we would leverage it. And then briefly, I wanted to sort of look at some of the trends within the enterprise space and how they're impacting large data things. And I think all of these are coming into play. Virtualization and cloud certainly are being thought of for large data things, although I'm not sure if it's as natural of a fit. Converged networks and all these things, like I said, are starting to have an impact. I'm going to talk briefly about a few of these. One that wasn't mentioned in this computer world kind of list was anything about magnetic disks, but I just wanted to at least say that, you know, there are still advances going on in that space, and so we're starting to near the end of kind of the capabilities of the vertical recording methods that we're using today. So the next kind of set of technologies that are being mentioned to go to the next level is things like heat-assisted magnetic recording or bit pattern media. So these are ones that are on the horizon, and there are some examples of that. They're talking about densities eventually of 50 terabits per square inch. So this is almost an order of 50x from where we are today. So, you know, 50 terabyte drive, does that not scare you, right? And unfortunately, so you've got a lot of capacity, but the bad news is, once again, the bandwidth's not going to increase to the same level, and this is basically because the bandwidth scales sort of as the root of the areal density, whereas the capacity grows linearly with it, right? Just another sort of general observation is it looks very clear, at least to me, that SAS is probably going to slowly replace fiber channel in the enterprise market. It's already sort of happening. Just a brief slide on converged fabrics. So this has kind of come out of nowhere, at least from my standpoint. We already had examples in the HPC space where we were using InfiniBand in this fashion. You know, it supported things like SRP for storage, and certainly you could run IP over IB over it. So we've had a converged fabric to some extent, but the enterprise space hasn't fully adopted it. That's true. Cisco has really come on strong with their COE stuff, converged enhanced Ethernet offerings, and you're seeing the rest of the market kind of follow suit. Okay, I'm almost done. I think I'm in good shape. here they're trying to make basically a lossless fabric so that you can flow things like fiber channel over it. And even if we don't use them as a one-wire solution, they're still going to have an impact. The other one is flash storage. I'll go through this a little more quickly. You're starting to see price convergence potentially in the 2014 timeframe on a capacity basis. Maybe, maybe not. You know, there's challenges there. But already on an IOPS basis, it's having an impact. And so we've evaluated some offerings from that. I'll skip this. So this is sort of my last slide, sort of gaps and challenges for big data. So one thing is, it's sort of alluded to with the magnetic storage, is capacity continues sort of outpace bandwidth. And this is a big challenge for if you're trying to do large systems, for example, exascale high-performance computing systems. Really, this is a challenge. So, you know, maybe flash storage will come in and save the day, but the jury's still out. I think we have to wait and see. Better middleware can also help, but you still, that only allows you to use the bandwidth you've got better. It still doesn't make the bandwidth itself any cheaper. Really, one big gap that I see is that there's not an ecosystem for these tools. People are still using serial-based tools to handle large sets of data. So when people need to copy, tar, compress, you know, those sort of standard bookkeeping kind of things, they're still using the same tools that we developed, you know, decades ago. We really need an ecosystem of parallel capable, starting with at least multi-threaded, but really they need to be multi-node capable. Data integrity is a big challenge. We have bit error rates that haven't really improved, and now we're starting to approach those from the data volume standpoint. So we're really, you know, things like parity check on read and RAID 6 are, I think, imperative today, right? But in the future, I think we're going to need some type of end-to-end checks. And there's a CERN study that really illustrates this, where they were seeing lots of data integrity issues and didn't even know it. And then finally, lifecycle management. These data live a long time. You really need to think early on about curation and preservation of that data. So I won't spend any time on this. It's just a rehash. So anyway, I wanted to thank Julian Baril from Lawrence Berkeley Lab. He gave me a lot of the background information on the Planck project and CMB and stuff like that. So thanks to him. And then most of the cool graphics and all of that came from the European Space Agency website. So my kudos to them and others from Wikimedia. So, all right, thank you.
Hi, my name is Hugh Brown from the University of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. I just had one small question about your backup system with the 10 Sun robots. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the capacity was 60 terabytes, but that was sort of a made-up number because you'd never fill them all with the same capacity tape. Mm-hmm. Is that just a budgeting reason or something like that, or is there some other disadvantage that I'm missing?
Yeah, but a lot of times what you'll do is you'll use a mix of tape models. Some are well suited for small files. They have much faster seek speeds on the tape, and others are higher capacity, but they might have, it might take them a full minute just to get a tape loaded, right? So that's mainly what drives it. And there's cost as well, but it's mostly about access times.
Thanks.
Hi, Doug Hughes from DHR Research in New York.
Okay.
Thanks for coming. I'm wondering, in your experiments with GPUs, if you've gotten very far, are you finding that one, the lack of ECC is causing you lots of problems, and two, that if you want to put these in the cluster, you start to run into scalability issues with the interconnect because you have to make so many trips over the relatively slow PCI Express bus in terms of latency between things because the GPU is so fast in comparison to the latency between
data in, data out becomes a big challenge, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's those two things are the main reasons we've avoided them up to now, right? Is especially ECC was sort of just we already know that we've got to have that for these things, and so they were interesting but not yet adopted. You know, with the NVIDIA Fermi cards coming out on the horizon, they've added that. Data in, data out, I think, is still going to be a challenge, but you can sort of think of it just as another step in the hierarchy of the systems, right? And so we already deal with interconnects that can't match the memory bandwidth. So it's possible that algorithmically we can deal with it. I suspect this could be like, you know, going from vectors to MPPs, this could be the next progression in that. But in the advance of CUDA coming in and giving people really a way to program these things more efficiently, that could be a game changer.
So you do you run the the experiment twice in the GPUs just so you can, or three times so you have quorum, or?
We're really just starting to, we have not used them in production at all. These are just being used in test beds, right?
Pamela Howell, Esoteric Resources. Mm-hmm. Thank you for telling us the names of your machines. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people here, I don't have access to Craze very often. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you picked the name for the roadmap machine.
For which one?
For your next one, the roadmap machine.
Oh, so, that would be the Hopper. Oh, yeah, I didn't
know. No, you talked about Hopper.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that is the next system, and that will take us through into 2010. We usually buy systems on roughly about a two to three-year cycle. So the next system will be NERSC 7, and this is where we really start to wonder if GPUs are going to become dominant. Right?
Can I just have a follow-up? The speed and the storage on that next system.
So in my view, since I'm an I.O. person, I think the I.O. on the Hopper system's underpowered personally, right? I prefer a gigabyte per second per terabyte of memory is sort of my sort of rough metric, right? So, you know, in that kind of time frame, I would expect we would have petabyte amounts of of memory. So you really need a terabyte per second of I.O. bandwidth.
Thank you.
Yep.
My name is Jesse Trux. I'm also from DE Shaw Research.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit more about your file system additions or changes you did to GPFS and how you parallelized those? And also, is that available for other people to either license or otherwise use?
GPFS certainly is. Is that your question?
No, your modifications that you've done to it.
We've pretty much ran GPFS out of the box, but with a lot of collaboration with IBM. We've been a user of GPFS since our IBM SP days and really helped push them from that, from sort of a specialized file system to something that was generally useful, right? So I think we worked a lot with IBM early on to really push the envelope on GPFS. Today, I think it's meeting most of our needs. There's a few gaps here and there, but it's certainly extremely capable, robust, you know, management friendly file system. So most of the things that we've worked on have been more with, say, Cray and DVS and trying to find ways to deploy it on those systems. Yeah.
Okay, there's no more then. Thank you. I'll be around for a conversation later.
Yeah. Thank you.